Good afternoon. It's really a pleasure to be a part of this symposium. The work that I'm going to report was not done in collaboration with Jerry Ritchie, but I think for all of us who work in this area of research, the questions we ask and the tools that are available to us, you know, have been greatly influenced by the body of his work. And so I'm going to talk today about some landscape impacts on sediment sources and transport in the southeastern Oklahoma watershed. This work was the collaborative with co-authors from El Reno, Daniel Moriasi and Pat Starks, from Watkinsville, Georgia, Dory Franklin, and from College Station, Texas, Sarah Duke. And for those of you who are familiar with the Little Ouachita watershed, that's this watershed where ARS has been active since 1961, but today we're going to talk about a spin-off set of research in the Fort Cobb Reservoir watershed. So I'm going to talk just a little bit about the watershed and why we moved some of our research activity into it, talk about the objectives and methods for today's results, talk very briefly about some of the results we're seeing and the conclusions that are leading us into the next steps. So the Fort Cobb Reservoir is a very typical of reservoirs in the United States. It has been identified in the state as not meeting its water quality standards based on the tropic level, particularly in the summer months. There has been a TMDL established under the Clean Water Act, identifying phosphorus as the limiting nutrient in this watershed. Agriculture is the vast dominant land use in the watershed, and agricultural phosphorus sources have been identified as the source of concern. There has been, with the Oklahoma Conservation Commission, a water quality project under 319 funding that was operating from 2001 to 2008. And in 2004, when our team was restructuring our research to address questions under the National Conservation Effects Assessment Project, we identified this as a very appropriate watershed to work on for seep type related questions, and certainly enabled to be able to tackle that in a new watershed. Partnering with this 319 project was very essential. So the watershed is a mixed agricultural land use. The dominant crop is winter wheat, and there are also a variety of summer annual crops, cotton, peanut, and various other summer annuals. A very large portion of the watershed is also in grasses and pastures, and these are a combination of native species or Bermuda grass or other types of introduced species. There's a very small amount of forest and shrubland. The quote forest is primarily small stretches along streams, and the shrubland is largely encroachment of shrubs into pastures that are degraded. And the rest is miscellaneous roads, communities, et cetera, and water. The watershed is characterized by extremely sandy soils, fine sandy loams, loamy fine sands. They're highly erosive by water and wind, and with the exception being some of the siltier soils located on the western part of the watershed that's influenced by different geology. In 2005, when we were establishing this research, we had the opportunity to work with some colleagues from our partner laboratory in Oxford, Mississippi. So in collaboration with Andrew Simon, he came and worked with some of our staff to conduct a rapid geomorphic assessment. And I'm just going to not go into detail, but these yellow, orange, and red colors indicate channel reaches that are in active degradation and widening phases. So they're pretty unstable channels. There are other parts of the watershed that have relatively stable channel reaches. And another partner study that we did in partnership with Oxford team, we did one small pilot study on sediment sourcing. This was a single storm in 2006. It was not a large storm. It was about 15 to 16 millimeters in the area of the watershed study. But in that particular case, almost half of the sediments were coming from upland sources, but slightly over half were coming from bank and channel sources using isotopic methods. in addition to the type of focused studies on sediment sourcing and the channel parameters, in 2005 we initiated a study to try to give us a better understanding of the patterns spatially within the watershed. And so we established biweekly sampling at 15 light sites within this channel network. This is Sherwood McIntyre, who's an ecologist working on the team, and he's the person who's been responsible every 2 weeks for over 5 years now to get grab samples that have been used for sediment and nutrient analysis. I'm only going to talk about the sediment today. And in addition, he collected data with a Hariba probe that include pH and total dissolved solids that were part of our analysis. And this is just a map that illustrates the sampling sites by these little small gray boxes. The blue lines delineate the contributing areas to the sites. The red boxes are weather stations for rain gauge, where we obtained precipitation data. In addition, there are three state-operated comprehensive weather stations that give not only precipitation, but all the temperature, solar radiation, wind profiles, et cetera. And so these are the source of the data. And at one point in the talk, I'm going to give a little bit of information about stream flow, which came from this stream gauge on the Fort Cobb, which drains over 75% of the gauge flow in this watershed above the reservoir. So this little inset is just a kind of a monthly summary of the precipitation in the area from the Fort Cobb Mesonet station just below the reservoir on that map before, showing that we have summer dominant precipitation. So the ticks, and I forgot to copy over the lines represent the highest value from 1994 through 2009. The bottom ticks represent the lowest monthly value. And the boxes represent the mean value. So you can see that we have predominant wet months in the spring, May, and June, that we have a typical decline in precipitation in July and kind of variable climate the rest of the year. But you can also see that any month can be wet, any month can be dry. And so for the 5 years that we were analyzing in this study, I've sort of highlighted the monthly precipitation by colors to show that we basically were, as a hydrologist, I guess, fortunate that we operated in two pretty dry periods. We had one extremely wet year and a couple that were closer to the long-term precipitation of about 720 millimeters. But the dry years were particularly dry here in the spring months. And the wet year was particularly wet above the expected values in the summer months. This graph represents the kind of what a typical flow regime in this Cobb Creek stream would look like. And so this value shows for the stream flow data from a USGS gauge that's been operational since 1968 up through the 2009 study period. Basically, we determine the median flow value by day of year. That's what the dots are. And I just put a smooth 7-day running average. So you can see that we've got in this area fairly good flow rates through the winter cool months, even though that is not when we get the dominant precipitation, that there is a spike in the flow in the May and June period when we get that spike in our median precipitation. There's a very rapid decline in flow through the summer months, and then a more gradual recuperation in the fall. So the evapotranspiration in this watershed has a big impact on the flow regime of the creek. This graph is a 5-year, shows the 5-year cycle. The points that are connected by the line represent the sample dates. And so this graph actually is the, for each of the sample dates, we took the flow regime on that day, divided by the median for that day of year to sort of identify periods of our experimental study when we were kind of near normal flow conditions, which would be represented by this zero log line. Some periods where we were considerably below it, particularly in 2006, and then the second years when we, or the second phase, which was the last, most of the last 3 years, where we were, for the most part, considerably above the typical flow regime. So for the rest of the data analysis, we basically analyze by these two phases based on the fact that in the observed data, the mean, this is the mean sediment concentration collected in those samples, and you can see that there was a difference in the mean. One of my lines jumped. The dashed line would be the average concentration across the entire period. This solid line that terminates here at the vertical line is the flow concentration for the phase one, and this line is the average sediment concentrations for phase two. So based on the difference in the sediment concentration means and also this very similar pattern with standard deviations, we split the statistical analysis into the two phases. Once we had done that, we looked at spatial autocorrelation within the watershed. There's lots of reasons to expect that these data would be spatially autocorrelated. We basically tested two different autocorrelation matrices. One was contiguity, which would help us identify spatial autocorrelation that was linked to factors that spanned across the different stream networks. This could be related to soil, it could be related to cropping pattern, it could be related to particular storms that spanned water subwatershed boundaries. And then we also, if the spatial autocorrelation were linked to flow within the stream from upstream to downstream, we had a matrix based on upstream-downstream connections. And basically about half of the dates that we collected and analyzed did exhibit spatial autocorrelation, regardless of which matrix we were considering. In general, this second phase, represented by the red triangles, exhibited, I guess just to explain these polar plots, this scale around that perimeter is day of the year, starting at January 1st being zero. So these would be spring, or whatever, winter, spring, summer, fall dates. The red circle here represents a 0.02 Moran's coefficient, and that scale increases as it goes toward the outer diameter of the polar plot. So this indicates increasing spatial autocorrelation. And you can see that we probably had stronger spatial autocorrelation based on the upstream matrix, but it existed really with both correlations. And for sediments, we tended to have a higher values of the spatial autocorrelation in our summer warmer months. The next phase of our analysis was based on a structural tree model called recursive partitioning. This was done just to help us identify factors within the watershed that could help explain some of the patterns that we saw of suspended sediment concentration in the streams. And these recursive partitioning was done both by the hydrologic regime, the wet and dry phases, and also by the presence or absence of the spatial autocorrelation. So we basically ended up running eight data sets through the recursive partitioning. So contiguous or upstream matrix with or without spatial autocorrelation for each of the hydrologic phases. And we had a variety of landscape management, climate, and other hydrologic factors that we were looking at. For the landscape, we looked at things like contributing area, the average or the maximum slope of the contributing area, stream length and stream density, soil hydrologic groups. This was done on percentage of coverage from the Sergo database, the percent sand, clay, and soil organic matter of only the surface layer, geology information, and an index developed from our rapid geomorphic assessment of the unstable channels. For the management, really there were two primary factors we looked at: the percent of annual cropland in the contributing area, or the percent of that cropland that was irrigated, or irrigatable at least. And we had climate parameters related to precipitation, either maximum intensity or total in the two-week period prior to samples. There was a cumulative precipitation to look at longer-term precipitation ahead of sampling, and temperature. And then in the hydrologic variables, we looked at that stream flow ratio that I showed you the slide of, and some of the water quality parameters of total dissolved solids and pH. And this is just I'm not going to talk a lot about this slide, you'll be thankful to know, but this just shows the variables of all the ones we put in. These are the variables that were significantly identified under the recursive partitioning for one or more of the eight matrices. So precipitation are the ones highlighted in blue. Those certainly were the ones that were the most predominant in influencing our sediment concentrations. The red numbers are the ones that had a negative rather than a positive autocorrelation. So in general, these parameters were positively correlated with spatial autocorrelation. But some, in particular, total dissolved solids was negatively autocorrelated. And the only two variables that could have some, you know, logical management sensitive response were soil organic carbon and unstable channels. And those were, the unstable channels were positively correlated with the sediment concentration, particularly under the wet conditions. And just a couple of the key messages summarized off of some of what you saw before, that the precipitation, which, you know, is certainly no big shock, is certainly the dominant influence in the sediment concentrations in this watershed. There were times when the area or the stream length were significantly contributing. In that case, they were isolating some of the smaller headwaters watersheds as having lower sediment concentrations compared to those further downstream. I think the negative autocorrelation between pH and particularly total dissolved solids during the wet flow regime indicates the contribution of a higher proportion of base flow where the geology would be influencing the chemistry of the stream water. And that channel instability being the only management sensitive variable certainly indicates that I think that's one area we can continue to look at as far as conservation practices. The other message, the fact that percent cropland or percent irrigable land was not correlated, indicates I think that we have to look at really all of the land types and all of the land uses which have potential sources of sediment into this system. And as we move forward, this is just a slide that's really dominated our thinking about the future research we need to do. This is a slide representing a single storm that happened in August of 2007. It wasn't record-breaking, but we had, you know, gauges that caught 9 to 11 inches of precipitation in our watershed. And this is a slide of two adjacent fields nearby. A no-tillage and a conventionally tilled field. So even though we were looking basically at base flow conditions, sediment transport in this watershed certainly is dominated by these intermittent large events. And they can have very devastating effects both at the field and at the watershed level. This is a gully that transferred about 1 kilometer of space and took roads out. There was a lot of massive damage to roads, bridges, and infrastructure. So this watershed, while we still have to focus on spatial and temporal aspects of water quality parameters, these are very complex interactions between the biophysical, the ecological, and the management factors, and that better understanding of all of these sources and transport pathways is needed, and that's where some of these methods developed by Dr. Ritchie will continue to enrich our research there.